Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hello again to my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audience around the world, many in Great Britain. And you've probably been noticing that I do have on a great number of people from Great Britain. Today, I'm going to be introducing somebody new to most of you here in the United States, at least. And it's part of my continuing interviewing of the authors of the book chapters in an excellent book called The Sedated Society, The Causes and Harms of Our Psychiatric Drug Epidemic. James Davies, the editor. And it actually looks like before I'm done, in a month or two, I will have had everybody in the book on the air, which was my original goal. And some of them are very names, you know, familiar to anybody involved in the reform effort. Peter Gerze, my marvelous friend from Denmark, Peter Kinderman, who was on last week, and Sammy Tamimi, who's already been on, and Robert Whitaker, then Joanna Moncrief, really marvelous people and researchers and scientists. Today, my guest is somebody new to me, and I'll introduce by saying that at some point in his life, he will be known as the Earl of Sandwich. We Americans get very excited about these things. And he's currently the Viscount Hinchingbrook. Viscount Hinchingbrook. He might correct my pronunciation.
No, Peter, you pronounced it perfectly.
That's wonderful. You see, hear his voice. There's something about the British voice that we Americans adore. It's quite an interesting phenomena. Out of the blue, many of our ads on TV have people with British accents, whether they're real or feigned. I don't know, Luke. So his actual name is Luke Montague. And Luke is going to be, I think, one of my more interesting interviews, although God knows they've all been so interesting lately. Luke spent time at Columbia University, so he's been in the U.S. He worked in the garment industry, which is something I did in 1953 as a child. I went to work for a summer in my uncle's dressmaking factory. And it was a horror to see these little old ladies bent over their machines doing piecework at a mile a minute. I will never forget that. I haven't thought about it in a while, but it was something to behold. It had a profound impact on me to see how some folks in the working class felt compelled to work and probably had very few alternatives. After graduating from Columbia University, Luke founded a series of technology and media businesses, co-founded the Met Film School, which is one of the UK's largest private media colleges. He's been CEO there. He also founded an interesting group in Great Britain called the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry. I'm not a part of it, but it looks really good. I'm familiar with it. One of my other guests is also on that. And it's experts committed to reducing harm caused by psychiatric drugs. And he is still associated with the Met Film School, and just as a very interesting addition, he's trustee both the Dalai Lama Center for Compassion and the Inner Compass Initiative. I don't think we're going to be able to cover all of the most interesting things about Luke Montague in 1 hour, and we haven't even touched upon what his chapter is about, which is his own journey through the psychiatric system. So, very interesting man, Luke Montague. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Peter, thank you so much for having me. And I'm here in the UK, and amazingly, you sound like you're next door. So at least the technology is working.
Yes, it is. That's really, really good. Would you like to start out? I mean, you can start out anywhere, but you could start out if you want, just talking about what you wrote about in the book. You don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be the whole part of our show.
Sure. Well, I had what I've discovered is a not unusual experience of being given drugs that I didn't need and which ultimately ended up causing me quite a lot of harm. And my story begins in 1990, and I'd had a sinus operation, and I woke up from the sinus operation, and I had these terrible headaches. And, you know, the doctor came back to see me and said, well, I'm sure they'll go soon. And that was encouraging. But 2 or 3 weeks later, I still had a headache and I felt very dissociated. And I felt as though I also felt very anxious. And it was a very strange set of feelings. And another month went by and things didn't really improve. And eventually, I went back and saw initially my GP, and one thing led to another, but ultimately what I was told was that this was now unrelated to the sinus operation, and that I had what he described as a chemical imbalance of the limbic system. And that sounded so precise and medical that it was very reassuring. And he told me that he had, you know, just the thing to fix it. And I was given initially a tricyclic antidepressant, and that didn't seem to make any difference. And then I was put on another one and another one, and eventually I ended up on Prozac. This was now 1992, so, you know, a year or two had gone by. And having now discussed with other doctors, and I'm interested, Peter, to know whether you've come across this, it's clear that some people do have bad reactions to operations, and that in fact the general anesthetic can you know, cause psychiatric and other sorts of symptoms. What I understand is that if you let the body recover, it will recover, but that didn't happen in my case. I was just given drug after drug after drug. And so in the early 90s, I think I went through 13 or 14 different drugs as they tried one thing after another. And what I didn't realize then was that each time it was chopped and changed, I was having a withdrawal effect, which was exacerbating the symptoms. And eventually I stayed on a drug familiar to Americans as Paxil, known over here as Suroxat. And I was told just to stay on it. And so I kept taking this drug. I think the headaches went away, but I believed in this idea that like an insulin, a diabetic needs insulin, that I needed to take a drug to cure this imbalance. And that, in fact, was precisely what my doctor had told me. And eventually, in 2001, I decided that it was time to try and come off. I'd been running a couple of businesses. I'd been, as you say, Peter, at Columbia University. I went to film school there. I'd come back to the UK. I'd founded and managed a couple of different media businesses, internet business. And I came off the drug in 2001. I came off over a period of about a month, and I went into the most tremendous withdrawal. I was actually in New York at the time because we'd acquired another business over there, and I went to go and see a New York doctor because I thought, you know, that's, they probably have particular expertise in the States. And he misdiagnosed the withdrawal coming off the Paxil as a much worse illness, and said that I had, I think it was a major depressive disorder or something. But I felt really unwell. I couldn't really leave my apartment. I couldn't function at all. And he prescribed me 4 new drugs, one of which was Effexor, another was clonazepam, and then he prescribed me a drug called Wellbutrin and another drug called Zyban. And lo and behold, I felt better. But what I didn't realize at the time was that I was really just somebody whose body had become dependent on Paxil, and I was given another class of SSRI or SNRI with the Effexor, and I was knocked out at night with the clonazepam, and it wasn't surprising that I felt better than I had because the drugs were being reinstated, but, you know, with the addition of the benzodiazepine. And so because I felt better, I assumed that it was the drugs working rather than anything to do with drug dependence. And I came back to the UK and I set up a new college called the Met Film School, which you mentioned in your intro. I got married. I had 2 children. But all the while I was taking these drugs. And eventually I stopped taking the Wellbutrin and the Zyban without any problem. But I was still on the Effexor and the clonazepam. And after about 6 years on these drugs, I was seeing a psychiatrist in London who was a very eminent chap called Dr. Collins, worked at the Priory, which is a prestigious London rehab center and mental health hospital, if prestigious is the right word. And he said to me, well, you've been on these drugs some time. You know, you want to come off the benzodiazepine. You can do that the long way or the short way. And I said, well, I'm pretty busy. I'd like to do it the short way and get it over and done with. So he booked me in to come off in a detox. And I went in and the benzodiazepine was taken away and I was given another drug for a barbiturate for 7 days, and that was also tapered off. But 3 days after I was taken off the benzodiazepine, I entered a vortex of horror, the like of which I simply couldn't possibly have imagined before. My ears and head screamed with tinnitus. My body shook. My nerves felt as if a million volts of electricity had been injected into them. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't talk. It was an unbelievable experience. And he said, well, just hold on, hold on. And it reminded me of movies that I've seen. There's a film called Trainspotting in the UK, where there's a scene of a heroin detox, and you see the character just shaking and being violently ill. And I thought, well, this is my equivalent, and I've just got to get through. But the thing was that this benzodiazepine withdrawal that I was going through didn't stop. I mean, it went on and on. After a couple of weeks, you know, the very acute symptoms had died down, but I was left. Essentially, it felt as if I'd been lobotomized. I couldn't remember anything. I didn't know who I was or what I had to do. And I somehow got myself back home, and I got myself to work where I was CEO of this large film school. And I would sit in my office and I wouldn't know what I was supposed to do next. So I used to go and sit in my car and cry because it felt as though everything that I was had been taken away from me in some terrible way. My mind had been erased. And to this day, I still can't remember a lot of what happened in the months leading up to that detox. It's, you know, there was, at some level, something has been taken from me. So recovery from that was very, very slow. And I had to give up my job. And I spent 3 years sitting at home, really unable to leave my house. And I had two small children. I could do a little bit of childcare. But it was a really shocking state of affairs. And during that time, I discovered that there was a huge online community of people all going through similar sorts of things, supporting each other, pointing out resources, and in particular suggesting that I should read your book, Toxic Psychiatry, and also Robert Whittaker's Anatomy of an Epidemic. And when I read those books and I looked back at my medical history, I suddenly realized that that I had gone through a process of being inappropriately diagnosed and given drugs that simply perpetuated the problem, and each drug led to more symptoms, which led to more drugs, and that this was an absolutely insane cycle that I had to break. I'd come off the benzodiazepine, I was still on Effexor, and so I spent 2 years tapering off that very slowly, with the help of various support groups, and eventually I came off, and it is not fun to be in benzo withdrawal, but tapering an SNRI while you're in benzo withdrawal is another level of misery. But it was only once I came off the SNRI that things got even worse, and I started having this very severe sensation of nerve pain. A sort of burning pins and needles throughout my body, down my arms and legs, and also very acute tinnitus. Now, that was in December 2010 that I was drug-free, and since then I've got steadily better. So to anybody listening to this and thinking, my God, this is, you know, horrific and I've got no hope and I'll never recover, that's not true. You do recover. But it can take a very long time in some cases, and particularly where you've been on the drugs as long as I had, which was about 20 years, and also where you're taken off much too quickly, as I was. That seems to have a particularly devastating impact on the nervous system. But we do recover, and I am much, much better than I was. I still have some residual symptoms. I still have the nerve pain, which can be quite debilitating, and I still have tinnitus. But I have a good quality of life now, and I'm back at work and doing things that I enjoy. But as this all unfolded, I began to realize that this was a tremendous injustice. And if it had just been me...
Luke, let me take just a deep breath for a minute. This has been very, very, very good description. And folks, this is happening to tens of millions of people. That's no exaggeration. There are untold tens of millions of people, and most of them have no idea, the way Luke has, of what is happening to them. They didn't have access to the information. They don't live in Great Britain or the U.S. This is a catastrophe of proportions that are hard to find words for, and it's done under such fraudulent terms, like the mythical biochemical imbalance. That's, to the people who haven't looked into it, sounds so convincing and so real. The other thing that's so important is people do recover, and Luke is a very good example of what I experience in my practice, which is even if there are residual neurological syndromes from the drugs, people can go on to have really, really good lives. Luke, could you, before going on to a lot of your interesting activities and your discovery, you know, of the what's going on in the world, is there any more you could say about what enabled you to recover? Is there more you could say about that? Was it particular people? Was it the reading of the books? Was it the
It was a real. Sorry, Peter. It was a mixture of things, and it's worth talking about those. So, reading the books gave me an alternative scientific understanding of what was going on and exposed the fraudulent ways in which these drugs have been marketed and the myths that are perpetuated that we all just take for granted and most people today still believe in because they haven't heard this alternative, which is so compelling. I mean, in any right-thinking person who reads your book or Robert Whittaker's book, at the end of that, and I've given it to many, I've given them both to many, come back and say, "Oh my gosh, I'm convinced. I'm signed up. This is self-evident. It's a self-evident thing. Once you see the story and listen to the narrative." But so that was one thing. The other thing was the peer support. So on the internet, there are still a number of websites that help people. Benzobuddies.org is one. Survivingantidepressants.org is another. And on there, you will find people who have been through this experience and who now spend time helping others and encouraging others and providing things like tapering protocols and suggestions for symptom management. And it's a community, and you feel supported and encouraged by a group of compassionate people who've gone through the same thing. And without that, I would never have known about your book. I would never have got through because I wouldn't have had the support. And once you've been betrayed, you feel so betrayed by medicine and the medical establishment, what I ended up doing was thinking, I really am only going to trust people who've been through this themselves. And those were the people that helped. And then the last category, and this is something that we have in the UK, were the withdrawal support charities. And we have a few of these over here. In particular, I would acknowledge the Bristol and District Tranquilizer Project, which has been an organization going for 20 years, helping people come off benzodiazepines and now antidepressants. And there's a wonderful, wonderful man there called Ian Singleton, who I would ring up three or four times a week, sometimes twice a day. And Ian went through this experience himself and recovered and now spends his whole working time helping other people and giving them encouragement, because what you need to hear is that you're not going to be stuck like this forever, that you will get better. And it's really a repeat of that conversation, which must be terribly, terribly hard for people like Ian who do his essential work, because it's really repeating and repeating. But that's what you need when you're going through the horror of it all. So those are the sources of support. I mean, my family as well. I was very lucky, obviously, to have a family that understood and believed all of this. I was able to give them these books and link them to these resources, and they ended up talking to the people running these charities and the helpline that existed then. And that gave my parents and my wife and others some of the knowledge that they needed to keep encouraging me themselves. But without all of that, and Peter, what you say about tens of millions around the world, it doesn't bear thinking about having to go through this experience without that sort of support, because there's no way I would have made it. I would have just been given more drugs, and you know, I'd be in an even worse state in all likelihood.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Luke. We're talking with Luke Montague from Great Britain. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. Folks, remember, I also have a book out called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which also may be helpful in understanding coming off the drugs. I think for me, Luke, one of the most important principles of drug withdrawal is to go within the comfort zone of the patient, the individual coming off the drug. So I always try to tailor as much as possible the drug withdrawal to the comfort of the individual and to, you know, whatever deadlines the individual has set for himself or herself, is, you know, whatever contingent things are going on, like maybe during a vacation, you know, they try to go a little faster. But and you'd think that doctors, particularly psychiatrists, would be eager to pay attention to the patient's experience and help them go through it without having a catastrophe, which is usually possible if you stay in touch with the individual's feelings and experiences. It's often relatively easy with the, where it's just, say, one or two drugs, not multiple drugs for 20 years. It's never easy. But thank you very much for talking about that. Let's shift in whatever direction you want to take it now, about your work.
Yeah. Peter, it's just worth saying on this point about withdrawal that here in the UK, we're quite lucky insofar as with benzodiazepines, there is published literature supporting a slow tapering protocol. And this is the work of Professor Heather Ashton of Newcastle University. You've probably come across her work.
Oh, she's very well known here. I mean, anybody who takes a look at the issue will find her here in the U.S. Yes, she's done great work.
So she used to run a withdrawal clinic in the 80s, and I think ran out of funding. But one of the things that she was able to do when I had come off and I looked at official sources for withdrawal, we have something in the UK called the British National Formulary, which is the guide for all practitioners to prescribing of pharmaceuticals. And if doctors don't abide by this, then they are at risk of being sued for negligence. And we can come on and talk about my lawsuit in a moment. But one of the basis for my lawsuit, which was ultimately around inappropriate prescribing and withdrawal, was that this was not done in accordance with the guidance of the BNF. And the BNF is very clear that when you reduce a benzodiazepine, you need to do it at the patient's own rate, and that you, if you've been on it long term, you need to take it, the withdrawal period may be several months to a year or more. And so we have that, you know, written in to the official guidance that is provided through the Department of Health to doctors here. And, you know, in theory, that means that no doctor should ever take somebody off a benzodiazepine other than by following that protocol, because, you know, the risk is that they will be sued for negligence.
No, we don't have anything like that, unfortunately. And in my experience, many, many doctors still think that that it's a myth that the benzos cause severe withdrawal. It's really quite a terrible situation. I do think there's so much going on in Great Britain that is more hopeful than what's going on here in the U.S. at the present time. But good work, good work. Listen, there's so many things that we can be talking about now. I mean, I don't want to miss out on your larger ideas about the Dalai Lama Center. So let's hear some more about what you're doing.
Well, I mean, just moving on from my story, after I had withdrawn and as I started to recover, I realized that I had an opportunity, because my father is in Parliament over here in the House of Lords, to try and bring a spotlight onto this issue. And he took it up in the House of Lords, and he would start debates and contribute to debates around this issue of, in particular, benzodiazepine dependence. And that has led to a number of things. First of all, he recruited the previous president of the British Medical Association, the equivalent of the AMA in America. It's called the BMA over here. A lady called Baroness Sheila Hollins. And she was very moved by my father's description. She had also been president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists over here as well. So in a very prominent position, able to really help bring about change. And she set up a conference around about 3 years ago now to look at this. And the BMA invited various sufferers and charities to come and talk at that conference in front of senior doctors. And it's fair to say that the doctors, I went to it, and the doctors seemed absolutely appalled by what they were hearing and very moved. And the BMA decided on the back of that to gather evidence from different stakeholders, including patient groups, but also medical institutions, to look at the problem and see what needed to be done. And on the back of that work, the BMA, in October of last year, have issued a statement calling for a 24-hour national helpline here in the UK to help people who want to come off prescribed medicines. Now, at the moment, that covers benzodiazepines. It covers opioids. But it also covers antidepressants. And that was a really important victory that we on the campaigning side had, because we persuaded them through the evidence and testimony of people like myself that antidepressants were causing just as many problems as these other drugs. And it, of course, all psychiatric drugs can have withdrawal issues, and there are other classes of drugs that should be covered by the helpline in due course. But we do at least now have a call from the British Medical Association, supported by the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the Royal College of GPs, the Royal College of Physicians, as well as numerous patient charities, for this national helpline. And we're working with them to persuade government that this is something that they should do. My father also helped with the setting up of an all-party parliamentary group. It's a committee within Parliament, which is called the APPG for Prescribed Drug Dependence. And I work in that alongside Dr. James Davis, who you've interviewed and who edited the Sedated Society. And we are the secretariat, and there are a couple of other people helping as well, for that group. Campaigning on this issue of a national helpline. And we think we're getting quite close. We've held meetings with very senior people in the Department of Health, including the public health minister herself. And at the moment, they are considering this demand, and we will keep applying the pressure. But I think we're closer than we've ever been over here to a point where something has shifted, that there is this recognition that these drugs cause harm and that people need help coming off and they need services to support that process. And so that really opens the door. If we can get the helpline and they can gather data about people on different classes having these difficulties, it opens the door to wider recognition, I think, of the issues associated with psychiatric drug harm.
You know, I think this show, more than any other, Luke, is really emphasizing some of the things that you, the leadership in the psychiatric reform movement is getting done in Great Britain. Some of this we've never talked about, even though I've been, you know, I've had multiple folks on from Great Britain. So, and it sounds like you're very much in the center of this. So thank you for this. Thank you, Luke.
Well, I mean, the other people that you've had on, I should just mention. So Professor Peter Kinderman, Joanna Moncrief, James Davis, Peter Gertscher, and Sammy Tamimi, they're all members of another organization that I founded, as you said, with Dr. James Davis, which is the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry. And it's we're a group of very concerned individuals, researchers, academics, etc. The focus of the work, as I say, is the helpline at the moment. But we also built a website, which was really, when I was recovering, you know, I thought, what can I do? I need to start trying to use my brain again. You know, it took me probably 4 years before I felt able to do it. And I went back to something that I'd done very early in my career, which was making short films. You know, I'd been running a film school, but now I was back holding the camera. And so I created this website, which is cepuk.org, and made films of people who had recovered, who wanted to tell their story, but also, really importantly, people like Joanna and Sammy and James and Peter and others talking about these issues. One of the things that was clear to me in withdrawal was it's very hard to read. Your vision is distorted. And so video seemed like a really good way to communicate some of these points and, again, to give people encouragement. And that website's been a huge success, and lots of people, I think, have used it as a source of support. And we have a resources and support section which links to some of the charities that work and some of the Facebook groups that can be very helpful. And so that was another important strand of my recovery. I mean, it was through doing this work that I began to feel better and more confident, and, you know, it enabled me to get back to where I am now.
Yes, it can do a lot. There's so much for folks when they become engaged around these issues. We're doing pretty good. We got about 20 minutes left, maybe 15 or 20 minutes left. I'd love to have you just talk some more about your engagement and in all of these activities, and also, as I've said, about the Dalai Lama Center, because I just think it's so important, a little bit you told me about it, about bringing compassion to society. So I'm going to make sure we get to that.
Okay. I'm now at the point where I spend about a day a week on campaigning issues to do with the helpline and the all-party group and CEP. And I spend about 3 days a week now working in Dorset, where my family has some property, which is a rural estate and farms and cottages, and making sure that the water is flowing and that the electricity functions and all those sort of good things, which is, you know, completely different. And it's good to be in the countryside and in a different kind of environment, you know, as I'm still recovering. But the other thing that I'm involved in, as you say, Peter, is this charity. It's called the Dalai Lama Center for Compassion. And it's an organization that's been given some funding by the Dalai Lama to promote compassion in society. And I'm sure many of your listeners will know that compassion is the Dalai Lama's great message for the world. He says that, religion is like tea, different religions are like different types of tea. Some people take it Indian, some people take it with lemon. In Tibet, they heap lots of salt into their tea. I didn't know that. But that the common denominator in all tea is water. And so the common denominator in all of the great faiths is compassion. And the purpose of this charity is to promote, compassion in society. And we're starting off by developing a course for schools. I don't know how it is in the States, but the school curriculum here is absolutely chock-a-block. It's very test-oriented. You've got lots of targets for schools to hit, and schools are rated based on the success of the children in exams at different stages, which leaves very little room for softer subjects, and in particular, there is currently only the religious studies curriculum as a place to learn about ethics and values. And those things can only be taught in the context of a religion. And again, in the UK, we have an increasingly secular society with more than 50% claiming that they no longer believe in traditional God or faith, as was the case for my parents and grandparents' generations. And so there's a gap. There's a gap in terms of where children growing up in society are learning in a formal way about ethics and morality. And so what we're looking to do is to develop courses that we will take to schools and offer to them to integrate into their curriculum. And we have a terrific partner over here, a very prominent school that is trialing this program with us. And given my background in film, we're going to do it, a lot of it, through video. So we're making films about different topics under the kind of umbrella of compassion. So we're just making a film on forgiveness at the moment, and helping schools to integrate this content into their existing curriculum, but also to create new spaces where these sorts of things can be discussed. And I mean, looking at my own children, I would be delighted if they could find more time to talk about the reasons that they should both support each other rather than fight each other at the end of the day, and how that will benefit them directly rather than being something that they should just do because their parents tell them to. I think there's a real opportunity, and I think in this increasingly less compassionate world, it's urgently needed.
It relates very much to, you know, my own emphasis on empathic therapy and our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education and Living. It really totally dovetails with my own goals. I deeply believe in that ethics, that the good life, that any hope for the world is based in empathy, caring, compassion. Compassion is in many ways a stronger word than empathy, but I think I would have trouble talking about compassionate therapy and without sounding like I was going a little bit too far away. But I don't know. I mean, I really like the concept of compassionate therapy. It's in some ways stronger than empathic therapy. It's a good idea. I'm glad.
Yeah,
very glad you're doing that.
Well, it's early days.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it's early days. This is a 10-year plan, but what we're seeing is that schools are increasingly receptive. That they realise that they have a role to play that goes beyond academic achievement, and that well-rounded children need exposure to you know, thinking not just in traditional subjects, but in also what it means to be a good human being and to show care and understanding for fellow pupils and the wider society. So I think we're certainly finding that the schools are interested, and we just need to now get on and make really compelling materials, because the problem with a lot of this sort of content is that it can be quite dry and difficult for children to understand. And so the challenge is to turn it into engaging content, video content, games and role play, simulations, and also get the children to go out and explore these ideas themselves with their own projects. Perhaps the children go and make films and interview people and talk to others. So it's a fascinating area, and it's also one that you know does have a research base. There are studies that have looked at the teaching of philosophy in schools, and have proved that at the end of a course, children are not only more literate in terms of their use of the ethical vocabulary and understanding of ethical concepts, but they find that at the end of the program, there's an impact on behavior, and that's been measured. So we think that it will be an absolutely fascinating thing to do. And for me, it brings together different strands of my life, you know, my experience in education, running a film school, and also, I suppose, the experience of going through something so dreadful, which I, you know, I now look back and I think that it was an absolutely inevitable part of my life. It was something that has given me a great deal. Though there was tremendous suffering at the time, it's opened up all sorts of other doors, and it's turned me into a different sort of person. And so this project with the Dalai Lama is a really good bringing together of these strands, and I'm really excited by it.
Yeah, I think it's an absolutely wonderful idea. I'd love you to email me any stuff you think it would be helpful to me in connecting to what you're doing in regard to compassion. I think it's the centerpiece. When I work with children a lot, Luke, but always with their families, because I believe that the parents are the ones who really need to learn to relate to their kids, not me. And I, twice this week with two different young people, one 14 and one 9, I talked with them about caring and empathy, because they had really lost track of it, especially while being medicated. They really almost didn't have that capacity, or certainly didn't have it fully while being medicated. And I think one of the tragedies of drugging children is that you're impairing, during growth and in development, the highest levels of spirituality, because you're impairing frontal lobe and limbic system function. And some of the kids, when they come off the medications, they really haven't grown over the years in terms of being able to care about other people. And often they feel defensive at that point, that they're mainly interested just in maintaining their own pride no matter what. And they'll fight to the death and don't want to be vulnerable. And talking about the strength of being compassionate, the strength of caring, can be very helpful to them. And talking to them about how if they can actually show this kind of caring toward their younger brother or sister, you know, they'll make a friend for a lifetime. They'll have something that other people mostly don't have, which is at least one other person in the universe who's just going to be there for you. And try to tell kids about the strength of their approaching people in a caring way. But I think I'm going to use compassion more as a result of our conversation. I just get a little concerned. It's a very heavy kind of a term, but it's, I think it's the right term in many, many ways.
Yes. Well, the Dalai Lama uses it as a as the sort of lead term when he talks about ethics. It's within compassion are other ethical constructs, and compassion is really the umbrella under which other things such as forgiveness and forbearance and tolerance all sit. So I think it is it is a powerful term. The Tibetan word is means something in addition to compassion. It's a broader word, but it's the best translation that we have. But I shall certainly link you up with what we're doing at the right moment, and it would be lovely to come and talk about it once we've actually rolled it out and we have some results, because that will be the really satisfying part of this.
And I'd so much agree with you that the foundation of ethics is compassion, empathy. You know, Adam Smith, who's mostly known as the father of free enterprise or capitalism, he said from the beginning that you couldn't have competitions in a society unless there was a basis of fellow feeling, he called it, fellow feeling. Society, family life, personal life, it doesn't work without empathy and caring and compassion. It doesn't work. You can be the very rich man and be very successful in what you've accomplished, but if you don't have compassionate relationships, you'll feel empty. You'll feel like there's a big hole in your heart. So I'm very, very much in favor of your emphasis on this. It's kind of nice to talk about it on the air. I haven't talked so much about it.
Well, there also seems to be some support for the idea that altruism, which is obviously linked to this idea of empathy and not wanting another human being to suffer and to thrive, there are good genetic reasons for, there's a genetics basis for this. So it's
well, an evolutionary maybe makes an evolutionary basis that's in our genes. That's you know, human beings. Going back to some great British thinkers, Charles Darwin dropped the term about competition and survival of the fittest, and in his great book, The Descent of Man, he uses that the term three times, survival of the fittest, once to debunk it, and he uses about 60 times the word love, and he makes very, very clear that what human beings have thrived on is cooperation, caring, love. And Darwin cites the golden rule as the greatest achievement of humanity. I mean, this gets very lost in teaching here in America. You never hear about Adam Smith or Charles Darwin as being great moralists who promoted the concept of love and caring and connectivity, cooperation.
Yes. Yes. Well, this idea of doing unto others the golden mean, I think, is really at the foundation of a successful society. And it would rather appear that parts of the world have lost their way currently. And so anything that we can do from the bottom up, I think, is really important. But it's there's quite a mountain to climb.
Well, there always has been that mountain. I mean, that mountain's always been there in humanity. I think going all the way back to, in evolution, we evolved as family units. And we didn't particularly evolve to love the neighboring family units. We evolved and survived as extended families of 5 to 35 or 40 people. And to begin to extend the concept of family, which is another part of compassion, has been a huge struggle for humanity from the beginning of time, I think. I'm not even sure things are worse now, because at least there are millions and millions and millions of people who understand the importance of caring and compassion. But it is a wow, it's a long haul to think of human beings in that sense, you know, as all being our brothers and sisters and relating to them in that manner, nor is it always practically possible to do it. But that gets into a more complex political discussion.
Yes.
I really wish you the best with all your projects. Do you have anything left? We've got about just only a minute or two. Is there anything more you want to follow up with, Luke? I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, well, no, it's been an absolute pleasure. I think that, again, I suppose it would be a message for all of those who are struggling with coming off these drugs or thinking about doing it, and it's a message of real hope and optimism. I mean, once you get outside of the clutches of opening that pill packet every day and realizing that you've jettisoned something that has in all kinds of ways been causing harm, all sorts of things open up, and they open up in ways that you didn't really expect. And I also, you know, I still talk to some of the people who support me. There's the most wonderful woman, Baylissa Fredericks, who's been an astonishing source of support for me and so many others and help people come off these drugs. And I just want to sort of recognize and send my gratitude to all of those who are out there doing this vital work and to you, Peter, for providing really the medical basis and evidence for all of those of us contemplating coming off these drugs.
Well, you're very welcome. And folks, just picking up on the love issues and all again, my latest book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, the whole last third of the book is about becoming a source of love. That's the whole last third of the book. First third is about the evolution of human guilt, shame, and anxiety. And the second half is about identifying guilt, shame, and anxiety so you can overcome them. But the third half is about what we're concluding here with, which is love, compassion, caring as being the centerpiece of having a good life. And Luke Montague, our guest today, really radiates that you just radiate that aspect, that spirituality, Luke. I wish you the very, very best with everything you're doing. And in a few months from now or sooner, give me a jingle. Not what you guys say, a jingle. give me an email.
And, ping me. That's the modern term, isn't it?
What's the modern term?
Ping me.
Ping me. No, ping I didn't me. Know ping me. But see, I'm not the best technologically. It's my wife, Ginger Bregan, who keeps me technologically aware. Well, folks, the book
Ginger.
Again is The Sedated Society. It's got Luke's amazing description of what he's been through and a lot of other good people talking about the frontiers of psychiatry. And I want to just thank my marvelous audience for being here and allowing this to take place. I think today's been a very good contribution to many lives out there. Thank you, Luke, very, very much.